שלום, ברוכים הבאים, welcome to Awakening, Torah, Musar, Mindfulness, our weekly series, our public offering on the weekly Torah portion, where we engage in learning from God and our ancestors from the ancient texts of the Hebrew Bible. From the weekly section, from the perspective of Musar, in the Jewish tradition, and from mindfulness in the Dharma of Theravada Buddhism, where we are quite blessed to learn from these two ancient traditions to inform us of how we can respond best to the challenges of our lives. And if you've been following since we began in Bereshit, the first Torah portion in the book of Genesis, then you know that this is dedicated to all of us who have gone through, are surviving, are living their lives in response to, and sometimes through reactivity to the October 7th genocide in Israel and the ongoing kidnapping and keeping of captives, and of course, the ongoing war. So this is about us addressing the grief and loss and sometimes the trauma. And so this time together is time for us to take refuge in the practice, in the path, take refuge in God, take refuge in the teachings and being here together with the Institute of Holiness, here with me as the founder and director of the Institute for Holiness, Kehilat Musar Mindfulness. I'm Rabbi Chassi Uriel Steinbauer, and it is an honor to be here with you tonight. It is Motzei Shabbat here in Israel on Saturday, December 9th, 2023, at 9:50 in the evening here. It is the 26th Kaf Vav of the month of Kislev, the Hebrew month of Kislev, in Tafshin Pei Daled in 5784, the Hebrew year. We are going to be touching on the Torah portion that happened a week ago, which was the Vayishlach. And that happened on Yud Tet, the 19th of Kislev, in the same Hebrew year, 5784. And the date on the secular calendar was December 2nd. So we're going to cover this Torah portion right now. And then soon, in another series offered soon, we will jump into the Torah portion that just took place this Shabbat. Okay. So if you're following along with us or have learned from the previous week, then you want to be in chapter 32, starting with Pasuk Dalet, which means the fourth verse. And it goes through chapter 33, verse 31. And that's what we will, give you a general summary, and then we'll delve into what we need to kind of work on today. And of course, we will have our mindfulness meditation practice to bring this all together towards the end. So if you've been with us before, you know that we begin by covering our intentions, our kavanot for today's session. For those of you with vision or watching by video, joining us on our YouTube channel, seem to be locked here for a second. Give me a second. Joining us on our YouTube channel or on the blog, from the website, kehilatmusar.com, the YouTube channel, you will find us there. Please subscribe. If whether you're joining us by video or will be joining us by audio, whether that's on any of the podcasts that you can find, then you will hear me reading this instead of seeing what's before us. So what's before us, if you do have vision and can see right now, are three kavanot, three intentions for today's practice. So we see this time together during awakening, Torah, Musar, mindfulness, as an act of radical self-care, that we're taking this time to strengthen our own souls to be of benefit to others in the future. We also see this time together as something to strengthen our relationship to others so that we can be a better conduit of God's good to others when they need us. And the final thing, the final kavanah intention for today is to strengthen our relationship with God. It is something we're doing to strengthen our relationship with the Creator so that we can be a better conduit of God's goods to others when we need us. So may we merit fulfilling this today as we attempt to every week. I'm going to stop sharing for those of you who are listening by audio or on video watching. Some of you are joining us live right now, either in the Zoom room or on the YouTube channel or on even Facebook. And some of you through LinkedIn and Twitter, welcome to all of you. Here comes the summary. You know, I have to tell you, delving into this Torah portion, you all aware of Jon Kabat-Zinn's work, and he has a wonderful title of one of his books called Full Catastrophe Living. I often quote that. And I feel like if there's one patriarch and one Torah portion that's going to cover that type of life, it's this. It's Yaakov. His life is full catastrophe living. Just one thing after another. And this Torah portion kind of takes all of it, even the next one that we'll cover most likely tomorrow or the next day, Vayeshev, is just the same thing, okay? So, and then I thought about it. I always try to give a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. And I thought, actually, all the patriarchs had a bit of this full catastrophe living. You think about Avram at first before he became Avraham, you know, having to leave his family and everything he knew to having a famine when he entered the land and having to go down to Egypt, having his wife kidnapped and almost raped. Then arriving back in the land with his nephew, Lot, who they have to split up, his only family member left. He has to split up because they can't handle having too much cows next near one another. And then Lot is kidnapped through a warfare of five kings, and Avraham at the time has to go and save him. And then, you know, this whole time Avraham has been wanting to wait for a male heir, a child, and it's gone on many years, and that's not happened. His wife, Sarah, our first matriarch, gives her essentially kind of like a concubine, her slave Hagar, to him. She gets pregnant right away. They have a son named Yishmael. And then there's that chaos in the house regarding this birth and how Hagar treats her. It goes on and on. I mean, then there's like Avraham being told that God is going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. There's a whole argument. There's the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. We don't even know. Avraham doesn't know if Lot has survived. And obviously they told him that they're going to go save Lot, but he doesn't hear from Lot anymore. As far as he knows, he just doesn't know. And there's just one, and then he's told to sacrifice his only son, right? Which, of course, he has two sons, but here we're talking about Yitzhak. Here he finally has a son. He banishes Hagar and Ishmael based on his wife's orders. Just giving you a little bit summary that that's full catastrophe living, one thing after another. And then, of course, I think the calmest patriarch is Yitzhak, which is calm, probably in reactivity to trauma. There's a bit of a the freeze. If we talk about a fight, freeze, flee, or fawn as four of the typical reactivity to grief and loss and to trauma, it's Yitzhak, freezing. He stays in the same place. He doesn't leave. He only opens the wells of his father. There's just so much kind of self-contraction in order to cope. Not sure if there's much recovery going on there or healing, coping with his family, the loss of his mother. And it only ends, there's a little bit of catastrophe at the end when he's on the deathbed, he's gone blind, and his son, who is supposed to be the next patriarch, Yaakov, deceives him, lies to him. So here comes Yaakov. Yaakov is had to flee home, as you recall, because he stole the blessing from his brother, Esav, who at the time was planning on murdering him. In his own reactivity and his own anger, he was planning to murder his brother, right? And so the mother says, you need to flee, Rivka. And so, you know, Yaakov now has been away for 20 years, service with Laban, and he's ready to go home. So what happens here? What happens in Vayishlach? Yaakov sends messengers to his brother Esav after 20 years of being away. He lets Esav know that Yaakov and his family are returning to Eretz Ka'an, which is part of modern-day Israel. And the messengers return to Yaakov and say, Esav is actually coming to greet you with 400 men. Yaakov is frightened beyond belief, okay? And he's fearful that Esav is coming to kill him and his family, and he divides his family into two camps for protection. He prays to God. He sends hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of animals, perhaps as a peace offering and perhaps as some form of reparation for stealing the blessing. We'll touch upon some of this. Then an angel man, comes and wrestles with Yaakov all night, blesses him by giving him a new name, Yisrael. Okay. So, and basically it totally causes him to be disabled for the rest of his life through that wrestling. He's injured in his Gid HaNasheh, part of the hip that we come to know as the sciatic nerve section. And it's just one thing after another. Okay. We actually learn that we don't eat the Gid HaNasheh of an animal from this story, okay? That we don't eat that. It's not kosher to eat. The next day, Yaakov learns, essentially continues with his family to actually meet Esav, okay? The sun has come up. Esav runs after Yaakov bows seven times, which we'll look at, full prostration with disabled hip. Esav runs towards Yaakov, embraces him, kisses him, and they cry together. Okay. Then you think, okay, they split ways. There seems to be some form of reconciliation, some form of quiet, peace, something to that effect. And what happens when Yaakov enters the land? His son, his daughter, the only daughter that we hear of, Dinah, she is kidnapped and she is brutally raped by someone named Hamor, which means donkey. He's from Shechem. And you have to understand that they are strangers in this land, right? They're foreign still, okay? Her full brothers, Shimon and Levi, decide to go and kill everyone that is in the town of Shechem in response to this kidnapping and rape. Then, as if that's not enough of full catastrophe living, Rachel, who is Yaakov's beloved, dies giving birth to Binyamin on the road to Beit Lechem, and she is buried there. Okay, so then Yitzhak dies, Yaakov's father, at 180 years old, and Esav and Yaakov gather together to bury him. All right, that is our summary of what has happened here, okay? And there's so much material here, as we say every week. What are we going to cover? What could we possibly say? How can we learn from this, okay? So let's take a look. Let's take a look at the behavior. Let's take a look at where there's might be reactivity versus responses. Let's look at how, you know, the four ways that usually people deal with grief and loss and trauma, if they're not actually responding, is through fighting and freezing and fleeing and fawning. We're going to look at those, okay? So in verse 4 through 22, we see what unbelievably is the perfect story for reactivity, the storytelling and narrative that can go into someone's mind that has nothing to do with the reality on the ground, right? Okay, so what do I mean by this? Yako begins to totally fear returning home and encountering Esav after 20 years. Okay, 20 years have passed. He has no idea how Esav is going to be. He has no idea what's been going on the ground. He assumes the worst. He does real storytelling, okay? He takes every precautionary measure that he is able to do so. So first he gathers intelligence. What does that mean? Right, he prepares a stratagem for battle just in case. When he when they return and tell him Esav is actually coming to meet you with 400 men, he takes that 400 men as a message that this is going to be war. And so to give him the benefit of the doubt, you might say, oh, yeah, it seems a little, maybe Esav is coming to do war with 400 men. Maybe not. But what he does, he assumes the worst case scenario and prepares for this. So some people might see this as, oh, he was very much responding well in the moment and preparing for the worst case scenario, which is what people should do. And then for some of us, we see this as like reactivity, a lot of storytelling, a lot of, oh my God, this is going to be the worst case scenario. He's going to come and murder everyone. And or kidnap them, perhaps after he murders him. Who knows what the story is in his head? But he goes ahead and assumes the worst. He prepares for battle, a stratagem for escape, splitting up the camps. And next he prays. This is his next strategy. He prays to God and very careful. And the last part that he does, he tries to win over, to kind of calm down if Esav is angry and coming to do war. He sends 550 animals to placate him. 550. And it's not just as if he sent all 550 at once, which would be overwhelming in and of itself. He sends them in like droves, right? Like here's 100 and, you know, 15, and here's another 125. And then it's just over and over with like space in between them. And so that is just an onslaught, right, of these gifts, okay? And some people see this as a gift of, really just trying to be kind, a dispatching of a handsome gift. Really, this, in my opinion, is reparation for stealing the blessing. It is paying for the blessing, which we'll look at the language later on, okay? So, really, he's extremely careful with his speech. There's so much going on here at all at once. It's not just these three things. In his speech, he is constantly referring to Esav, even through the messengers, that you are my lord. I am your servant. Okay, he's immediately creating a hierarchy. Esav is the master. He is the lord, okay? And this is a form of conciliatory fawning, okay? This is a real response to trauma and fear, right? The fear of of what might happen, worst case scenario. And basically, even when in his speech, he hints at what he has, saying that he has lots of animals he can pay. He makes sure to leave out information that he has camels at first in order to save that as like a secondary measure. I've never seen someone who's so planned out so carefully in the midst of the acute moment. This is an acute moment for him, full catastrophe living. So he's doing everything, okay? He's planning on fighting. He is turning to God. He's fawning He's turning to him and saying, you're the Lord. And just in case he attempts to flee, which he, the fact that he puts everyone over on the other side and remains at, alone at night is a form of fleeing. It's an internal fleeing. It's a physical fleeing. And some people believe that just in case he actually was going to flee, God forbid he leave everyone else there. Some people believe that the angel was sent in order to stop him from fleeing. Because he's already done, if you know Yaakov's behavior, if we call about habitual reactivity that someone gets habituated to, it's from the time when he was a teenager, when he's sent away by his mother, Rivka, to flee his brother, to flee responsibility from deceiving and lying to his brother and his father. So he flees, right? He flees to Laban. And then when he lives all those years with Laban, he flees from Laban. He tries to run away, right? There's a constant fleeing. There's this constant, almost also fleeing just from conflict, not knowing how to be in conflict. It's like he doesn't communicate all these years and then blows up at Laban at the end. So we're dealing with someone who just doesn't have the full toolbox and skill. And he wasn't afforded that, no offense, from his parents who didn't communicate with one another, both loved two different children and deceived, the wife deceiving the husband. I mean, this is the household he grew up in, right? So we have to think when we're going through this. So let's look this. So those were the first verses. Those were 4 through 22. And then we move through why the defensive measures. And I mentioned the storytelling, the narrative, the movie that must have been going on in Yaakov's mind. These are verses 8 through 9. As I said, it's been 20 years. Is this wise effort? I know as I said, I'm not looking for exact answer, but we want to be able to reflect, do we do this in our acute moments? If we can try to be awake during them, and if we can't be aware and mindful during them, can we reflect on them afterwards, right? Like what happened with October 7th and immediately afterwards? What was going on with us? What was the narrative? What was the story that was going on, if any? You know, how did we cope? How did we react? Was there any form of fleeing, whether that's internally or physically? I mean, I knew many of my friends and even colleagues who physically got on a boat or plane and left. That's fleeing, right? And you might think, oh, that's not reactivity. That's a choice. I mean, that's a response. Is that a wise response? Is that done through appropriate discernment? We have to look at all this. Okay, there was also fighting immediately. Immediately, there was a sense of fighting and wanting a revenge and vengeance, right? And for some of us, it was freezing, like totally, I can't do anything. I can't even respond to this moment, right? And then, of course, there's others who moved to fawning. We definitely witnessed, of course, the people who are most affected by this, who want their children and spouses and family home who have been kidnapping. Sometimes we witness fawning. Please, Hamas, I'll give you whatever you need. We'll give you what you want. More and more prisoners, right? Just let me have my babies home. To the point where we even saw one mother, God bless her soul, say to Hamas, please take me. I will come to your border. Take me either instead of my children or let me come and be with them in the tunnel. This is a form of fawning. This is a way that we deal with grief and loss and trauma. So we want to look at this. We want to look at how we're behaving. So Yaakov moves on to confession and supplication to God. Confession and supplication, right? And I think all of us for the past 56 days since October 7th, 2 months, it was 2 months on the first night of Hanukkah, that we've been confessing and supplicating, right, to God. This is part of our response and some of us reactivity, right? Then he moves to gift giving, verses 14 through 22. And as I said, it's not just droves of gifts, right? Basically, this has a psychological effect. It has a physical effect. It's done incrementally. It's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. I could just imagine, like, the equivalent to Hamas, God forbid, right? And to Palestinian terrorists, like giving droves of the prisoners that they wanted, some at a time instead of all of them at once. Okay, then we move on to what comes next. Okay, talk about the full catastrophe living. What comes next? A mysterious assaultant, right? Which is just nuts. That comes up. Let me find the verses 23 through 33. Whew, okay. There's so much commentary on this section that I'm welcoming you to read it and look into it. It's not so much a concern for us, like who was the assault, the person, the angel person who fought him. Was he actually coming to do harm or not? We're just trying to learn today from this that when his name was changed as a form of a blessing to Yaakov, this is a form of purging the unsavory midot, the soul traits and behavior with which Yaakov was associated, with the name Yaakov. Who we know as Yaakov is someone we know as deception, right? Deception and fleeing. If I'm going to think of two words, deception and fleeing. Those, of course, we might say those are the negative ones. Giving him the benefit of the doubt, he's someone that has learned to pivot. He's a survivor. Yeah, he's endured a lot. Absolutely. But this name change to Yisrael is really like, may all that's associated with the name Yaakov be no more, right? We'll talk about that for next week's Parsha, because as much as our Jewish tradition loves the idea of a name change to kind of purge the unsavory midot from our past name and maybe past behaviors, it's like that saying, there's a betui, there's an idiom, like you can take the New Yorker out of New York, but you can't take the New York out of the New Yorker, or something like that. Well, that's kind of the same with Israel. That's the case. Like you'll see it in next week's Torah portion that Israel still has qualities of Yaakov, right? So then we move on to he finally encounters his brother. It's not as the movie that he had in his head, the storytelling, the narrative did not come true. It was all in his head, even with the 400 men there. So it just shows you how much we can create even more suffering by what we tell ourselves. So there's the stimuli. The stimuli that's coming is Esav is coming to meet you with 400 men. That's the reality on the ground. Then there is the response to that, which is really reactivity. It's what we call the second arrow. And the reactivity is, oh my God, he's coming to kill us. Okay. What could have been the other story? And maybe what would have been the effect of that? What if he just said, okay, he's coming with an entourage to meet me? He's just traveling 400 men, because that's how people who are the leader of a people and a whole tribe, that's how they travel. Whatever it might have been. There are different narratives that could have happened that wouldn't have caused so much suffering to Yaakov, where he did had to do so much acute planning, then wrestling with himself and the angel man who knows if that needed to happen or would have happened had there not been the suffering of the storytelling. So what we do know is that narrative did not come true, right? And whoo, talk about the adrenaline coming down, right? I could just imagine his kidneys in this moment. So he comes down. And what does he do during this moment of reunion and return? We're dealing with chapter 33, verses 1 through 20 now. There's this reconciliation. There's he does fawning. He does full prostration, full bowing Yaakov towards his brother Esav 7 times while he's limping with a hip that's been dislocated. Okay, total form of fawning. And the same kind of What was written when he left, when he fled? There were five verbs that were like staccato that were used in a row when Yaakov fled. And now when he enters to reunite, to do reconciliation with his brother Esau, there are again five verbs. And why do I point this out? Because like even with midot, with a midah, soul trait, there can be imbalance that are obvious on both sides of the continuum, but there can also be great balance. And here you can have five of the same verbs or five verbs, and they can be totally used for unsavory behavior, right? Unwise, unwholesome behavior of deception and fleeing from responsibility and such. Five verbs. And here, these five verbs are all about reconciliation, unification, maybe even a form of forgiveness or letting go in the moment, being present, allowing that release of hugging and crying, which is what they did together. Okay. So he basically convinces his brother to take these 550 animals. He changes the language from mincha, he was giving him essentially an offering, right, to bracha, which is what he stole from him 20 years earlier. And he's saying, take these 550 animals. This is the bracha, right? This is reparation for the forlorning of the paternal blessing 20 years earlier. So, even Yitzhak and Esav 20 years earlier used that same language. They use the term bracha. So this is a real reconciliation. And then there's disengagement, right? Esav wants him to come with him. He says, I'll meet up with you, which is a lie. He then goes, Yaakov goes on his own way, settles in the land, stays in where he was for about, they first think they in the first location, Sukkot, that is about 18 months, most likely, and moves on from there. All right. So you think, okay, he's entered the land. You think, woo, I could finally have some peace. Oh, right? What happens? Full catastrophe living. Chapter 34. His daughter, the only daughter we hear of, Dina, is kidnapped and raped brutally. This is really the next trauma. To understand rape back then in the ancient Near East, ancient Middle East, and from our ancestors, rape is a form of defilement, not only of the woman and her body, but of the clan, the people, and also of the land. It's behavior that is not to be accepted because it defiles everyone involved, and it's an outrage. It's not just a personal violation and crime against the woman and her body. It's not like how we understand rape in Western society today. Okay. So there is, it's a corruption of environment. And I guess the equivalent of this is it's as if Yitzhak had been slaughtered. If Yitzhak had been slaughtered, according to our ancestors and the culture of the ancient Near East, but particularly our culture, right? Jews who would not engage in child sacrifice, that would be an outrage. That would be a total defilement, a corruption of the environment. And so here is Dina. Here's Dina being sacrificed, right? When Yitzhak wasn't. Here's his granddaughter going through a form of sacrifice, right? And what happens to her father in response to this rape and kidnapping of her and being kept? Complete silence. Complete silence. I don't think this is him choosing this. I don't think it's him responding wisely with discernment. And I don't think it's wise speech, wise silence at all. I think this is his silence, similar to Yitzhak's silence after he was almost slaughtered. His lack of ability to be able to communicate with his father afterwards, they go two different ways, Avraham and him. This is silence in response to trauma, to grief and loss, right? This is a form of freezing. Oh my God, I don't know what to do, right? I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. Okay. And this is where we find Yaakov so much like his father, Yitzhak. Okay. Yaakov's reaction, lack of reaction, right? Or lack of an appropriate response to the moment gets taken over by the other males in the household, particularly her full brothers, Shimon and Levi. This is verses 30 through 31, who basically kind of scream at their father when, you know, he, for the first time, does speak up. And he's not speaking up about her being defiled or the land or the clan or the anything. He speaks up about the fear that they're going, that they put them in danger, that when Shimon and Levi respond to, and this also, who knows if, let me tell you, her brother Shimon Levi go and murder all the men and even boys who are involved, who are from the town where Shechem, where the murder takes place. And from our Western perspective, we think this is crazy. You don't hold everyone responsible for one man's act. But that's not at all what happens in the ancient Middle East. It sometimes doesn't happen in the Middle East at all today. What happens is the prince of all the people, who is the royalty of the people, he is the one that kidnaps and rapes, okay? And so from that perspective, all of them are responsible if their leader is doing acts like this and defiles the land like this. I'm not saying I agree with it at all. I don't agree with murdering a whole town in response to this, but this is what we have before us. So perhaps we could say they had a great reactivity to the rape of their sister and the kidnapping. There was a total vengeance and revenge, a total fighting response, right, to that. So Yaakov's reactivity finally comes out because he fears, because Shimon and Levi have murdered everyone, that they're going to put the whole family at risk because they are gerim, they are strangers in this land. And so for them to commit murder like this, he fears that the other people, the other towns are going to rise up, right? And hurt them. So Shimon and Levi is like, you know, totally the father. There's no way we could have let this happen to our sister. All right. So that's full catastrophe living. Do you think it ends there? No. The final one here, so sad. The final one here is Reuven, the firstborn to Leah, right? And we all know how Yaakov treated Leah. He did not love her, did not even want to be with her after she produced six sons and the most amount of children of all three women combined. He goes ahead, and it says in the language that he laid with Bilha. To me, it's like a form of rape, even though it doesn't say that. He lays with Bilha, who is the maidservant. Essentially, she was the maidservant to Rachel, who was the beloved of Yaakov. And when, just from a little bit of anthropological perspective, when the next patriarch in line, the eldest son, goes and usurps like the power of the father, right? Who goes and sleeps with one of his wives, one of the concubines. Excuse me. This is a clear sign that he's trying to take over power. He's trying to say, I'm going to tell the show around here, right? And so what his concern is in this moment, most likely, is Rachel has passed away. He's fearful that Bilha's going to be raised to the next position, right? Because she's with Rachel as being the next wife with her. And he really is tired of this whole thing that Yaakov set up 20 years earlier by favoring Rachel. And he wants his mother, he wants Leah put in that position, right? And so this is how he behaves. And here we go again with Yaakov, complete silence. We hear the verb shema, he heard what had happened. And that type of hearing, you have to know when the verb shema is used, shen min al ayin, it means a reaction to an offense usually, and meaning it connotes that that something was wrong and that someone's going to respond to this soon, right? That suggests that something is impending. And that doesn't come. It doesn't come right now. It comes on his deathbed. Comes on Yaakov's deathbed. So here we go again with Yaakov with the freezing. Doesn't respond wisely, doesn't use speech wisely, doesn't use silence wisely. So as I said, here's this ancestor with full catastrophe living. And it's almost like one trauma after another, one really unsavory, unpleasant event after another. And sometimes, and most of the time, I think we're witnessing reactivity. Sometimes some people may be open to the concept that there is really response happening here. I think the key thing in all of us, for us to move into our mindfulness meditation practice, is what are we witnessing here? What are we witnessing that we could use ourselves in this moment? Because what we have before us in this beautiful text that's been handed on to us, in order to be a map, what is it that we can learn and how can we practice and be in this moment, is really about the mida of menuchat ha-nefesh, equanimity, which is known as upeka in the Dharma. This concept of we're really most deeply concerned with cooling the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. That's really the concern with equanimity, particularly from the Dharma. And it's really a freedom from being governed by old habits, by old reactivity, right? The sense of old patterns of behavior, of craving, of aversion. And the genocide of October 7th, the kidnappings, the ongoing war, these events in and of themselves knocked us off balance. Normally, in less traumatic and acute moments, we're not necessarily knocked off by the event itself, by the stimuli. We're knocked off by our reactivity. But this was such over the top, as we all know, the genocide of October 7th, the kidnappings, and everything associated with that, and the ongoing war, that those events, and this event in and of itself, it knocked us off balance. And then we have to look at, did we further knock ourselves off balance with our reactivity to all of this? Which most of us did. If we're going to be really self-compassionate towards ourselves, we have to look and go, yeah, I had a lot of reactivity. This is my reactivity. I'm going to slowly be able to talk about it. I'm going to slowly be able to journal about it and work through this and this coping, right? On this path, not necessarily towards recovery for some people, but healing slowly over time. So our ongoing reactivity to these events can surely knock us off, especially if we have aversion, right? The not wanting. I didn't want this to happen. I don't want this to happen. Every day, I don't want this to happen. And the sense of like wanting things to be different than what they are, and that not being able to respond because of it, because we're so locked in the not wanting. And this leads to confusion. It leads to reactivity. It's a blight on our lives, right? It hinders our capacity for responsiveness. And so for some of us, we're still so locked in that, right? We're locked in either fleeing or freezing, right? Or such reactivity of fighting, right? So with that, we're going to move into a meditation on equanimity, on upeka. When I ring the bells at the end of it, it's time to come out of the meditation. For those of you new to meditation, you'll hear me lead most of the meditation with words guiding the meditation. But sometimes there will be moments of silence where you are to sit and just watch whatever arises without reactivity as much as possible, just witnessing with curiosity, with goodwill, as a friend, as a best friend to yourself. That kind of curiosity, the beginner's mind, as we call it. What's going on with me? What's arising? Right? So with that, I encourage you, if you're sitting, to come to the edge of your seat. Perhaps some of you are on a zafu, a cushion. If you want, need to stand, please just stand. Go ahead. That's one of the four postures of mindfulness meditation. Also walking back and forth. And then for some people, you'll need to lie down, and that's absolutely fine. For me, I'm going to sit at the edge, really ground my feet. I'm finding, most people responding to such grief and loss, that I need to practice grounding every single day. And part of the grounding is really to feel in your body, to be embodied as much as possible. So to sit in the sit bones, feel the heaviness in the chair if you're seated. If you're standing or walking, you'll feel the heaviness in your feet, which is what I encourage you to do right now too. Really feel your feet. This way, that way, you're being held by Mother Earth. If anything feels unsafe, please open your eyes, see that you are safe in the room, that you're here with me. You can come and even come out of the meditation, do what you need to do. Okay, what I'm going to guide you in is safe as far as I know, and have worked with people for many, many years on this, who have gone through some form of grief and loss and trauma. So I invite you to settle into whatever posture you have chosen, one that enables you to feel in contact with the ground or wherever you're lying on. And when you're ready, I invite you to close your eyes if you feel safe and ready. If you want to keep your eyes open, that of course, just let your gaze come to rest on the space in front of you or on the floor in front of you. And we begin with three deep cleansing breaths. Inhalation and exhalation. This time, raise your shoulders up to your ears. Inhalation and exhale. Ah. This time, inhalation and exhale. Ah. Letting your hands rest wherever they're comfortable, perhaps on the lap in front of you. Really just allowing yourself to settle and fully arrive here. What a gift to yourself to take this moment. Allowing your breath to come to its own natural rhythm. In guidance to his son, the Buddha is reported to have said, make your mind like the elements that don't react to whatever is thrown at them. I'll repeat that so you can hear it slowly. Make your mind like the elements that don't react to whatever is thrown at them. Equanimity, this menuchat hanefesh, this calmness of the soul. I like to call it a centeredness of the soul. A balancing of the soul may be associated with the earth element. So, as we sit or stand or lie down or walk, really valuing that contact with ground, with the floor, with whatever you're sitting on. Receiving and allowing the sensations of this contact. Actually appreciating them. The earth element may also be experienced in the weight of the body, the sense of substance in our limbs. Sometimes we can notice patterns of tension or uptightness in the limbs. See how it is to invite a release of the body into gravity, into its natural weight and fullness. The poet Rilke said, "Patiently trust your own heaviness." I love that. I'm going to repeat that. Patiently trust your own heaviness, your own here-ness. I am here. I'm created in the likeness and the image of the divine. I am here. And this can be a moment-to-moment practice, right? A practice of equanimity as we stand or sit and breathe. Equanimity, this upekkha, this menuchat hanefesh, is also embodied in the vertical axis of the body. The sense of uprightness. So, finding this imagined or sensed vertical midline running from above the body, like Shefa, abundance, and grace from God, down through the top of the head, down through the front of the throat, touching the front of the spine and descending through the pelvic floor into the earth. Really tapping into that vertical line with the source of all life, knowing that you are connected from heaven to earth. What a beautiful thing to begin to center yourself around, to rely upon. Aligning with this gift, this vertical axis, moment by moment, can be a practice of equanimity, a practice of balance in the midst of this full catastrophe living, in the midst of changing conditions. And the impermanence of it all. Grounding, verticality. These are supports for embodied equanimity, sensitivity, and presence. This practice is a spacious allowing of the ever-changing fields of body sensations, the ever-changing colors and textures of mood and thinking, of narrative, of storytelling, of the movie that we sometimes create and allow, the rising and passing of sense impressions, moment by moment, breath by breath. The attitude of equanimity, the practice, the full embodying of it is a mindful allowing, is a mindful breathing with. Present moment breathing with the winds as they blow. Knowing that this too shall pass, this too shall change with time, whether I am ready or not. So, in this practice right now, letting the orientations of grounding and verticality support your equanimity of allowing this experience to unfold. Just as it is in this moment. And in this moment. And with this breath. The practice of allowing is a practice of relaxing with, of ease in the midst of all things in safety, in refuge in community, in refuge in God, refuge in the path. Sensing in the soft tissue of the body whether there are any patterns of holding, any of contraction that can be softened, released, expanded, that can be allowed to let go into gravity and presence. What would it be like to fully be here? Do you notice fear arising? Do you notice any storytelling arising? I know lately in my practice, when I attempt to fully embody, to fully allow, my chest immediately tightens and I feel fear. I recognize the fear, the emotion. I attempt to be with it and let it be. And then I ask myself, what is the story that I'm about to tell, that I am telling my body right now? The fear is that I won't be able to live with feeling the full pain, the full grief and loss that I carry, that we all carry in response to this genocide, in response to the lack of support through some peoples, may feel like the majority, it probably isn't, but there's some very strong voices of not support throughout the world. And we allow that to go into us, into our pores. What would it look like to be able to ride the waves of this information, this stimuli, this lack of support? To realize that our allies are riding the waves with us, that we are not alone. Can we be on this full catastrophe living, this thing we call life, without getting lost in it, without being able to be fully present for it, because the fear of the pain, of the grief and the loss of fully feeling it. So maybe you are like me and feel the soft tissues of the body holding this contraction. Can we ask ourselves, can we be with this right now in safety together? Can we allow a little bit of release? Can we ask God to be with us and help us, help each other? Recognizing on this third night of Hanukkah, as we bring stronger and stronger lights into this, recognizing that all experience is changing, just as the candles begin to burn away. And finding that steadiness in the midst of this change, we light and we light again, fully knowing that the candle will burn out. It may be that quietly repeating together, changing, changing, changing. Maybe that can support our embodied, heartfelt practice of upekka, of equanimity, menuchat hanefesh, the centering of the soul moment by moment. Or maybe it could just be the simple word, allowing. Allowing, allowing. Maybe these words can soften the textures of the body and heart into the field of change. Equanimity is the ultimate recognition that this too will pass. This too shall pass. We can practice together this moment by moment, embodied, present, sensitive, and allowing. We will sit for a minute of silence before I ring the bells to take us out of the practice. Allowing your eyes to gently and slowly open if they were closed and you have vision. Giving Hashem God a loving bow and a bow to yourself and your practice, to this community of taking refuge together. Today's awakening, Torah Musar Mindfulness, is in honor of Jill Spanier, the beloved Musar Mindfulness practitioner, a member of one of our Vadim Musar Mindfulness groups, who went through a bout of illness and is now recovering at home. And her beloved Vad is honoring her today by offering sponsorship of today's session. So we thank this wonderful Vad that has been together for many years, Musar group, Musar Mindfulness group. So if you would like to sponsor a session in loving memory of someone, or just to honor someone who is with us today, please reach out to me via email from the website of kehilatmusar.com, and we would be delighted to mention you or whoever you sponsor. And we thank you for enabling us to offer these free public offerings so that we can reach and touch as many souls as possible with what we hope to be very helpful to all of us in our lives, in recovery, in coping, and on this path of healing, on this path towards holiness. Thank you for your practice today. May we merit fulfilling what we set off before we began, and we may continue to move through Hanukkah, bringing more and more light as we head towards Rosh Chodesh, the new moon of Tevet, on Yom Revi'i on Wednesday, starting Tuesday night. And you will see me soon. We will go over our next Torah portion of Vayishev very soon and continue into our learning and practice. Thank you so much. Take care.